Well, hello everyone, good evening, and welcome to another episode of the Civil War Regiments podcast. I'm very pleased this evening to be joined by actually a Catholic priest who is also a living historian. And his name is Father Brian Brooks. He's from the Diocese of Tulsa in Oklahoma. And I've been able to serve with Father at a number of reenactments over the years. And I've looked forward to having a conversation chat about what that's like, you know, juggling the duties of a priest while also trying to enjoy living history, and also talking about the roles of chaplains in a Civil War regiment and how that impacted the soldiers during the war. And so with all that being said, thank you for joining me this evening, Father.
Oh, thank you for the invitation, Stephen. It's glad to be part of this.
Yes, yes, good. And I was just noting earlier that we run into each other at a number of reenactments, but we don't always have quite a lot of time to chat about all these things. And so this is a good opportunity to kind of spend more time on that. And with that being said, we actually, both of us just attended, if you're a Civil War reenactor, you've been hearing all about it on social media lately, but there was an event by the Liberty Rifles in First Section called We Soon Got Proud, which was recreating a full artillery battalion of the Army of Tennessee in northwest Georgia. And it was a live firing event. We got to shoot actual targets, you know, with recreated, you know, missiles and everything that would be fired out of these projectiles with these artillery pieces. And so my ancestor was in the artillery.
Oh, okay.
So for me, that was a treat to be able to experience that.
Wow.
But Father, what was that experience like for you, being able to recreate Civil War field artillery like that?
Well, it was amazing. I think maybe the last time this was done was 1865.
Yeah.
We did everything by the original manuals, as well as the organizers. My hat's off to them. I think they spent 2 years planning this out. Went off with hardly, if there was a hitch, I didn't see it. Of course. As I told the organizers, I've never done artillery. I've only done infantry. I was asking how much experience I've had around horses, and was next to none. I was tempted to say, "Well, I know they have four legs, and you know the boats go in one end, and something else comes out the other, and you know." But no, I just don't have. And they just said, "Well, try not to get stepped on." I said, "I will do my utmost." But it was just great that and I told them that just to be there, I'll do anything you need me to do, and. Just to be part of it, that was just an amazing experience and incredibly unique.
Well, what was mind-boggling was after we were done, you know, they let us go down range to check damage to the targets.
Yeah,
and that was incredible because not only did we tear up the targets pretty good, but seeing the carnage behind the target in the line of trees and how far. How far these projectiles went,
right?
And just seeing how deep they burrowed into the ground, and it was really remarkable, and it made me realize that I would not want to be on the receiving end of that.
You want to be on the giving and not,
And somebody said the other day, like, oh, too bad we didn't have any cameras downrange, you know, for audio or visual, but nobody wanted to risk that damage one hit and your camera's gone.
Just this one solid shot from a found Napoleon. Yeah, we're done. So,
So I was thrilled personally to be part of that. And I knew as soon as I heard that event announcement, I was like, I have to be part of this because my ancestor was in Dalton, Georgia around that same time. And he was in an Alabama light artillery unit. So, my unit got to be in the Barber light artillery at the event, which was close enough for me, doing what he may have done.
Yeah.
So, but that's just a taste of the kind of events that me and Father have been able to have the fortune be part of over the years. And
just the technical side of it, a lot goes into manning a gun. You have eight men, they have all to know what they're doing. Each one of them has their job. You have the tools, and that was I was given like the job that if something went wrong, I was least likely to get anybody hurt. You know, so I was back tools and helping to pull the ordnances out of the caissons, the ammunition chest.
Oh,
And so, but just even to, and make sure, and then make sure the lid was closed, you know, between the live fire and all that. So, but just to be there, but just how the teamwork that was required to make all that happen. And that's just with the guns. It's not counting the horses and the mules and everything.
Correct. And wow, you're on the, to me, that was the scary part, being on the Kazon, because I was like, I don't want to handle the ammunition. But I was the number four on my crew, so I pulled that lanyard each time.
Oh, good for you.
And so that was exciting. And we were locked in, man. The four guys on the gun, like we got locked in. We took it so serious, man. Oh, yeah. And everybody did. Everybody all weekend took it all very serious, because they all knew how serious it was, what we're handling. And so props again, to hats off to all the guys who managed it and organized it and supervised it. It was great. So, wow. But all that being said, yeah, I can't wait for the next opportunities for all that. But for the conversation at hand, you know, before we dive into our chaplain conversation, if you will, I always like to ask my guest, you know, where did it begin for you? And so where did that interest for history begin for you, Father? And how old were you? And, you know, when did you find that desire to pursue history?
Okay, great question to start out with. But I'll preface it saying that yes, I am a Roman Catholic priest. I'm in the Diocese of Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm currently the pastor of the Church of St. Benedict in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, which is a suburb in the Tulsa metro. I'm also the vicar for priests for the diocese. And yes, my bishop does know that I do this. I will go out and be firing live artillery, and my closest friends know it as well, in which some of them said, this once again shook their heads and said, well, at least at the funeral we can say you died doing what you loved. And but of course, as you know, everything went fine. Nobody got hurt. This we soon got proud. But your question about how did I get involved in history? I was about 4 years old.
Oh, wow.
One of my earliest memories. And I was visiting my mom's, her South Carolina side of the family. And it was in Greenville County, South Carolina, upstate South Carolina. And my great-grandfather, William Gresham, who's also known simply as Daddy Bill, he's being the South, and everybody's got their, you know, they've got their name and they got their other name. And I was in the front porch of his house, and he was literally the son of a Confederate veteran. Wow. And I remember him saying quite clearly how is the way he put it. He said how his pa and his uncles had been in the Wawa. And that as if he was of a generation that grew up, I think he was born in the 1880s. And for them, there was only that was the war that mattered. You know, of course, he'd lived through two world wars and all that. But it was in how he put that. And sure enough, as I that sparked something or planted the seed. As I got older, you know, I had the American Heritage book, History of the Civil War for Children. I think that was one of probably the first books that I wore it out. It has like those illustrations of the battles of the little figures. You know, I probably literally counted every and my mom would, you know, joke about that. But sure enough, as I began interested in history and family history, and I'm kind of now the genealogist of the family. And sure enough, that Daddy Bill's dad and his oldest brother, he was the youngest of three, his dad, Robert Gresham, he served in the 16th South Carolina, who also would have been at Dalton, Georgia in the spring of 64, but in an infantry division. And he was 18 at the time, at that time. He had two older brothers, both of whom were in the Virginia Theater of the War, William and Hugh. William survived the war. Hugh did not, and Hugh died of disease. After the war was over, William and Robert came home and married biological sisters and got on with their life. And so, but then it sparked me to do more and more deeper dives, the family history. Found out eventually that on my dad's side of the family from Alabama, but they were Unionist. They're from the northern border of Alabama, and they remain loyal to my on my dad's family, my great-great-grandfather was in the Union Army. He enlisted in a Tennessee regiment, Tennessee Mounted Infantry. And then eventually, many years later, homesteaded in what's now Southwest Oklahoma. But it took almost decades of trying to find records of him as a Confederate until finally said, well, you may want to try the Union records. And boom, found him like 10 minutes or something like that.
Wow.
So that's how I got interested in that. And then at the age of four, and then went on to got into the living history of reenacting when I was about 19 years old. I was at a gun show in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm from Oklahoma. I was born and raised in Oklahoma City, but my dad was into, we were raised with guns. the joke that our house was the neighborhood arsenal, you know, just in case the Red Army invaded, you know, Oklahoma City.
You were ready.
We were going to be, yeah. And so we went to, so I grew up going to gun show. At least by the time of 12, I think it was when I was 12 or 14, my dad got into that. And when I was about 18, 19 years old, I went to a gun show, and there was a group of a living history group that had a table set for recruiting people. And I was like, where do I sign? You know? And so I started doing that. I was a freshman in college and began doing that, and have been doing it, you know, ever since. I began with a Confederate impression, and then done a Union impression for a long time, and now just for we soon got proud, had to do Confederate infantry, so I had to get a whole new, you know, show up for a whole new uniform. Said, well, okay. So that's how I got into this this hobby, and I am the kind of guy that I probably now travel alone when I take some time off to go see the most obscure historical places, so I don't have to bore family and friends with all that. But I don't inflict my my situation upon them, I put it that way.
I hear you there. I understand. But wow, that's wonderful. And I love all the stories, and especially the stories of all of our ancestors leading that. And I was in Barnes and Noble a couple of nights ago, and I always every now and then try to find out what's new, right? And what some of the recent releases. And it was a brand new book. And I'm going to have to look it up, but it was a brand new book on the 1st Alabama Union Cavalry.
I listened to a podcast about that the other day.
Okay.
The author. Yeah.
Okay. Was it, I think he's a professor or something from Massachusetts, or he used to work for the New York Times or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I need to, I'll share it in the show notes for the episode. Forgive me for forgetting the title.
Another book like that came out a couple years ago, and my sister got it for me for Christmas a while back, called True Blue. And it was about the Union loyalist in the South, including they took from New Orleans, that was one regiment, another from Northern Alabama, the 1st Alabama Cavalry U.S., and then and also the in Tennessee Unionist, and it focused on them about why they were Unionist, you know, what happened to them during what happened to them after the war, that sort of thing. So
it was rough for them afterwards.
Well,
I'm sure
I found out there's a reason probably why my dad's family wound up in Oklahoma.
Yes.
And in Alabama, you know, they were pretty much disenfranchised after the war, after Reconstruction. So, and a lot of them too, they were, if you go to a place like Stillwater, Oklahoma, Oklahoma State University, is that where I'm a graduate of? You have places that are named after guys who were some of the founding fathers who were North Carolina Unionist, and they probably that they just went west. They had to. They were not welcomed back in their home.
Yeah, that's something. It's really something. I remember one of the first reenacting units I did was we portrayed a Kentucky Union unit, and I remember hearing that even after the war, a lot of Kentucky Union soldiers were treated as like Confederate veterans after the war. And they were like, hey, we fought for the North. Yeah. We fought for the Union. And they were disrespected after the war. So it was troubling times for so many. And then that's what populated the West there for a while, was all those veterans moving west. So,
and the author of that book, which you probably were the author of the podcast, he said one of the things that those guys got written out of history.
Yeah.
And that they're almost all but forgotten back. If you go to Kentucky, Tennessee, Northern Alabama, you know, that's they've been all, pretty much forgotten. Even
Yeah.
did stay there, so.
Yeah. Which people were trying to erase history and all.
Yeah.
every timeline in history has gone through that at some point or another. But wow. Which that kind of leads me to think, was, forgive me for my ignorance here, but was Oklahoma a state during the Civil War?
No, it was not. It was, it didn't become a state until 1907.
Okay. Okay.
But we did have what's now the eastern third of the state was known as the Indian Nations. Basically,
okay.
What we would refer to now as the five civilized tribes that were relocated out of Georgia and North Carolina and Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, Florida, are wound up in eastern Oklahoma. The Cherokee, the Muscogee Creeks, the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, the Seminole. Those are primarily. You had other native peoples that were also being such as the Osage, the Iowa, and others that were either before the war, or during or after the war, were forcibly resettled here.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Yeah. So much of that area, like, yeah, I forget it. Like, you know, Missouri was still almost Wild West during the Civil War, and so a lot of these states, weren't. But like, it's funny, you go even further west, and you had a few units from like Utah, I think, and a few things during the war. So, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. But you know, to get back on subject here, Father, you know, I'm curious myself. You know, obviously, out of college, you obviously pursue the priesthood,
right?
And you become a Roman Catholic priest.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested, and I think our listeners will be interested to hear. How easy or difficult is it juggling your duties as a Catholic priest while also trying to still, you know, fulfill your hobbies and things you like to do,
right,
like attending these events like We Soon Got Proud? And you've obviously been able to make it work all these many years.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how that goes. How does that lifestyle for you?
Well, it's always been, you know, the priest thing comes first. And I'm a parish priest. And so it has... multitasking, just regardless of the side of the parish. In fact, some of our priests in rural parishes, I mean, they're the pastor, they're also the janitor, they're the yard guy. You know, they do almost everything, at least in these very small communities. But I have to be pretty picky, I have to discern carefully. I just can't, you know, take up and go. For a weekend, I've got to plan that out. Often, at least a year in advance, 6 months at the minimum, because I've got to coordinate. I'm fortunate right now to be in a parish where there's an assistant, there's an associate pastor. So, but also to make sure that I coordinate with his calendar that he's not scheduled to be away for something that particular weekend. Or if times I've not had an associate pastor, I've had to work around that and make sure I get a priest to come in and take my place for hearing confessions and offering the mass and so on the weekends that I'm away. I've also incorporated some of these events into my basically some vacation time. When I was young, before I in the seminary, it was not unusual for me and other guys, you know, you've probably done this too, okay, whether last class on Friday or you get off work Friday, you jump in everybody carpools, you drive half the night to get there. And then Sunday afternoon, you load everything up and you drive half the night to get, gotta be at work at 8 o'clock on Monday morning, that sort of thing. Well, everyone's like, yeah, I'm not doing that anymore. And that it just didn't fit well into my overall schedule. So I would, ideally, I would say, like, I'm going to for a weekend. I would leave maybe on a Wednesday, and then take that time, and maybe and have the time. But I'm not, you know, driving through as fast as I can, you know, on the interstate. I can stop and see these little places along the way or on the way back. That whenever I can, I've been doing that for a number of years now. That whenever possible, instead of driving straight through, that I have the time to stop and see what I want to see. For example, on the way back from Georgia. This weekend on Monday, I stopped in Northeast Arkansas for a total solar eclipse. I was in totality, and it was absolutely amazing. It was just one of the most incredible things I've ever experienced. So that's how I've been able to try to fit it into my schedule, planning far enough in advance, and also saying, well, what do I want a unique experience at this point? And also realizing I'm 62 years old, so sleeping on the ground in the cold takes a lot more out of me than it did, say, when I was 22 years old. And so I have to take those things in consideration as well. So those, but that's how I'm able to juggle all that with my again, my first responsibility is to the people of the parish.
Well, it is motivating to see that you've been able to make it work so much over all these many years. And I know again, I've been blessed and fortunate to we've crossed paths at many events before. And honestly, this is another good question for you is I know like at many of for those listening to a lot of times when we're recreating a full-scale battle or we're having a reenactment somewhere, it's not always on. We're not always able to do it on the actual battleground. Or the actual battlefield. It could be private property near or close by. But there have been times where we have camped on the actual battlefields. And for me, I got a lot out of attending mass with you at some of these locations. And so like on the actual battlefield or in many cases I remember some of the ones that come to mind for me are it was Chickamauga 150th and you had mass for us on the hilltop and there was this sunlight behind you. It was a beautiful experience and
Because
very prayerful.
15 hours, whatever. The sun is up, praise God.
Yeah, I know. We finally dried up a little bit of that one. And then another one, there's been a few times where, or at least two occasions where I was your only mass attendee. It was just the two of us. And one was at the Pea Ridge reenactment. I went to Arkansas for the Battle of Pea Ridge reenactment. And that was, you know what? I remember one fun fact about that weekend is that same weekend was when Pope Francis came to the United States. If you remember that, I remember while we were there, that weekend was when the Pope came to the World Meeting of Families. So I remember because I remember that I was like, well, we were out of touch, I didn't hear about it until I got home, all the news from it. But the only other thing I remember about the Pea Ridge event, it was really hot, but I remember we were camped where we parked our cars in Arkansas and we slept in Missouri.
Walk like several miles over the border.
We were right there on the border of Missouri and Arkansas, but that was a memorable event too. And but for you, Father, is there a moment or a highlight for you that sticks out at any of those events or none that I listed or one that you just had a blessing where you were able to offer mass somewhere that you never would have been able to otherwise?
This was a number of years ago, and it was in Arizona. And it was back with a group that's known as the Army of the Pacific. And we were doing a California regiment that spent 3 weeks trying to find the Apache in southeast Arizona, in which they had no idea where the Apache was, but the Apache seemed to know exactly where they were. And we had pack mules. There's maybe like 25 of them. The pack mules, horses. We had to pack in all of our food, all of our water. This is quite unique. So my mass kit was basically as minimal as possible, and the altar was a wooden box with a candle, and I mean just as bare minimum as we could. And then while we're doing this, there was maybe four or five of us that were there, and it was a Saturday night, and all of a sudden a full moon comes up over the mesa. And one of the guys, he said, "Man, this is like, it's like the first Christians were doing this." It's like I was expecting, like, man, the Romans are going to seize us and haul us off to be martyred. Imagine this is what our brothers and sisters in Christ, a couple thousand years ago, they were having to do this. Now we weren't doing it secretly, but we were, but the idea, but having that moon come up, and Sean Malis and Dom DeBello, if you know them, they're out in California. They were two of the guys that were there, and then they said, like, "This is this is pretty incredible. So
Wow.
that one stands out to the different times, because always make opportunity when possible during the weekend reenactment to offer mass. And usually with the organizers, I contact them in advance, try to make, get that publicized, get the news out there, and then and also get permission from the local diocese. But that's usually not, that's never been a problem, doing any of that. So.
Yeah, that's great. And it's been a blessing. I've been blessed to be part of a few of those moments. But yeah, you can't top that really in Arizona like
Yeah.
that. That was something.
On cue, the
Wow.
full moon pops up and it shines off.
I always say, like, yeah, get into living history because you're gonna experience things that you otherwise may never have encountered. I say that especially for those of us who aren't in the real military, right? There's a number of real military veterans and active members who reenact on the side, but for those of us, for me, an armchair historian, it's the best way for us to experience is being able to do living history and attend these events. But wow, yeah, thank you for that story. But okay, so we're talking today too about chaplaincy during the Civil War, and how it worked for a Civil War regiment, and so I know there was chaplains, on both sides of the conflict. You had chaplains serving Union regiments and chaplains serving Confederate regiments. But how did that all come about? Was something like that already implemented in the military around that time, or was that? I was kind of curious. Is that something that the local families kind of requested? Like, hey, if our boys are going to war, we need a priest to go with them, or were did the government assign, a priest to a unit? So, as far as the origins go, how did that all go about for
Okay.
chaplaincy?
Well, it's unlike today, when we have a whole military chaplaincy, and we have actually two of our priests in our diocese are serving as military chaplains, both of them in the Air Force. That they go through this whole training and have to be accepted, and you have actually a whole structure to do that. In 1861, there was nothing like that for either North or South. They basically had to start from scratch. I think there had been. During the entire history of the U.S. Army from 18, let's say, 1818 to 1838, there was one chaplain in the entire U.S. Army. And he was an instructor at West Point, and he was basically a professor of geography, history, and ethics. So he's kind of like did the chaplain thing on the side, as opposed to being the full-time thing. So you had barely a mention of chaplains in any of the military regulations. So you had to basically. There was no even what to do. What's the role of a chaplain? What's the job description? What rank are they going to have? What uniform are they going to have? What is going to be their pay? What are the responsibilities? So for both sides, you had that going on. You had or at least for the Union military, eventually it comes about that they're paid, I think, $100 a month. They have the rank of a captain. The Confederacy, I think, is like $80 or $85 a month. Similar rank structure. You also had that. There was by the end of the war, there was a set uniform for Union chaplains. Basically, kind of a black suit type thing. Although you see the photographs of chaplains, whether Catholic or Protestant, wearing all sorts of things. You see some chaplains dressed that you couldn't even. They would look like, company commanders. There's nothing to distinguish them as a chaplain. And with the Confederates, it's basically they came up with their own style of uniform. I don't think there was anything, to my knowledge, that was set about that. You had also, at least by the time the war is over, to be a Union chaplain, you had to have basically letters of credentials from whether denomination or church that you were from, that you were suited for it. You then had to have permission from the officers of a regiment or a brigade, and then being and also appointed by the governor. The Confederacy was less so much of the documentation. But interesting, the Confederacy that we're kind of thinking of the South being more religious well, they were not kind of, they were kind of lukewarm to the whole chaplain thing, because they needed every available able-bodied white guy with a gun. Put down the Bible, grab
makes
the
bullet sense.
Type thing. And so they were reluctant. I was like, well, we don't, and also the detail guys that were good and healthy to doing this instead of being combatants. So they eventually found kind of way to do that. Sometimes you had the local minister would go, like, you know, how a lot of these Richards were raised originally from a geographical area. Well, their pastor or whatever church they belong to would often go as well. You had a couple of different priests. That was their thing. Father John Bannon, he was in Missouri. He was a priest in St. Louis. A lot of his parishioners were members of an artillery unit in the Missouri State Guard. So he winds up going with them as they join the Confederate Army. And there are cases of him at least twice helping to man the guns in some aspect. So maybe talking about artillery at Pea Ridge and then Iuka in Mississippi. So you had that. You had Father Peter Whelan, priest in the Diocese of Savannah, Georgia, a similar type thing. He's at Fort Pulaski, and he's taken as a prisoner, and then he's later paroled, and he winds up then taking care of the POWs at Andersonville in the latter part of the war. So you had also then men who wanted to go, but then they were reluctant, or their congregations might be reluctant to send them. And also in the case with from a Catholic structure, a priest also had that permission from his bishop or his religious superior, say his religious order priest, like at Notre Dame. You think of the Notre Dame priests such as Father William Corby. We had to have his superiors, the priest that was in charge of his community, give him permission to do that. And interesting enough, the Holy Cross Fathers, they had 21 of them at Notre Dame. 7 of them became chaplains in the Union Army.
Wow.
The commitment, they sent a third of their able body. And these guys were, before the war, had been professors, teachers, you know, because they were teaching order. Their one of their main charisms is education. And then they go off to war. And so you had a kind of a variety of things, but you had the one of the main things about them, that there was not anything written yet about what it meant to be a chaplain. So it also took, who was it going to be a chaplain, be effective? You had to be an incredible self-starter, highly motivated, being put in a position in which you've got to make up your own job. Yeah. And you got to do it. But basically, the ones who took care of the men, their spiritual needs, in the army, they would have services on Sunday if it was possible. And particularly in the campaigning season, it was not. It was rarely possible, and the services would be extremely limited, in terms of time for the most part. You had also taking care of the other needs of the men, their physical needs. The chaplains would write letters. They would ensure that the money that these men, then they were paid every other month, but instead of blowing it on euchre or whatever, or game of chance, or going to the sutler or going somewhere else, that the money was sent home to the families. They organized reading circles, Bible studies, plays, concerts, Amongst the Irish Catholics, there was a big move. This sounds strange to us today, about temperance. We're not going to drink alcohol. We take a pledge, because you had the stereotype of the drunken Irishman, you know, or like University of Notre Dame fighting leprechaun, you know, mascot. And they would do that. Would pass out religious tracts, Bibles. And of course, in addition then of leading church services for Catholic priests of offering mass, hearing confessions, anointing the sick, or what we call then extreme unction of the last rites, and burying the dead. And for those who actually gave themselves fully into that, regardless of their Catholic or Protestant, they were pretty much widely, almost universally respected by the men they served. And the ones who didn't were scorned.
Yeah. And it sounds like definitely chaplains were that moral compass accompanying the men throughout the periods of the war. And also, like, in a way, because many times it might be the local pastor going with these men to the front. It's almost like it's that home connection as well, you know, where they're bringing home with them out in the field. And so that's another incredible touch.
You also had with there was one, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, another Holy Cross priest who had been a professor, I think, of physics or biology. He gets permission to go in the Union Army, and he shows up at Vicksburg during the siege. And he basically meets, in his letter, he meets General Grant, who basically says, "Well, Reverend, glad you're here. Hope you can keep up." And was given a tent and a horse. And the next morning, he looks out, and there are like 40 or 50 men who've heard, "Oh, there's a priest." And they've come to him. And they had not been able to take part in Mass in months. Because they think there may be two... There's maybe one or two other priests in Grant's entire army. So Ben spends the next couple of weeks riding from division to division throughout the siege lines and dodging artillery rounds and all sorts of things in order to do that. And he said it was hard to keep up. And he was in his 30s. A lot of these chaplains were late 20s, early to mid 30s. Father Peter Whelan was the exception, the one who winds up serving in Andersville. He was about my age. He was in his, he was in his early 60s at the time. So definitely, it took that kind of drive, dedication, fortitude, and faith to make that happen.
Wow, and it seems like there was also a number of, of course, United States is full of immigration around this time. And there's also a lot of immigrant priests coming overseas, it seemed like. I know there was a few, one that I wrote a little article about before was Father Amerman Blimel And he was a Bavarian priest who was assigned to Nashville. He was assigned to a parish in Nashville before he inevitably became chaplain to the 10th Tennessee Irish Confederate Regiment. Right. And so... So you had a lot of that. Obviously, there was also that greater need, especially in the Union Army, with these overwhelming regiments that are German and Irish. And, of course, they're also heavily Catholic. And so it's amazing to me to hear, like, just one or two priests catering to an army of 80,000 men, per se. Yeah. You know, but it makes me wonder, too, like, was there ever cases of multiple chaplains in one regiment of multiple denominations? Was there ever a documented case like that in a Union regiment where they might have a Catholic priest and a Protestant chaplain in the same unit?
Then probably not, from what I can tell. I mean, you asked earlier about how chaplains were selected. And I've got a quote here, if I can find it. It's one of my favorite quotes, and it comes from, a father, Joseph O'Hagan. He was with the 73rd New York Infantry. He was Irish born. He was a Catholic priest. And he was a Jesuit. And he says when he was the elect chaplains were often elected. These were Jacksonian Democrat with a small D type outlook. And he says the men voted who they wanted to be a chaplain and what denomination. And he said of that regiment, the 73rd New York, he says over 400 voted for a Catholic priest, 154 any kind of Protestant minister, 11 for a Mormon elder, 335 so they could find their way to hell without the assistance of clergy.
Wow. Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's
those sorts of those sorts of things that's how that they were elected. There were total, in terms of Civil War chaplains, total numbers are around 2,300 Union chaplains and about 1,200 Confederate, which may be about 3% of those were Catholic priests. I think a total of maybe 71 documented priests that served. And they would have been in regiments that might have been on a post or a garrison or hospital chaplains. So they would have a kind of variety of duties. You had, look at some of my notes here. You had, in the Union Army, the chaplains, you had 11 were killed in action.
Oh, wow.
Had four mortally wounded, 73 died of disease, and 200 approximately died within 5 years after the war as a result of the illnesses or injuries they had suffered while on active duty. And with the
that makes a lot of sense being up, you know, I'm sure so many up close with the men right. dying of diseases and everything right. else. Right. Wow.
You had, almost 100 chaplains. Again, these were mostly Protestants. They were, I think 3% of the chaplains were Catholic. Most of them, majorities would have been Methodist on both sides, followed by Presbyterians, Baptists, and so on. But of those chaplains, almost 100 Union chaplains were mentioned in official reports by name for their dedication to duty, and four would later receive the Medal of Honor. Of the Confederates, wow. you had nine that were killed in action or mortally wounded, including Father Bemmel, who was a Benedictine from Germany.
Okay.
Right. He winds up going into Nashville, follows his parishioners into the Confederate Army. You had another 32 Confederate chaplains who died of disease, and another 20 that were wounded in the line of duty.
Wow. Well, you know, Father Bemmel, I went to his gravesite. He's buried in North Alabama over in Tuscumbia.
Okay.
It's either Florence or Tuscumbia. I forget. It's one of the North Alabama little towns.
Yeah.
And I went to his gravesite. He was actually... So he was killed at Jonesboro,
right.
Battle of Jonesboro, and for a while there, he was just buried on a farmer's property down there. And a fellow seminarian priest, a friend of his, came over from Bavaria
yeah.
and got assigned to the same diocese that he had been in. And he kept asking about it. Where is he? Where is he? And all people could remember, like, last I heard, he went to the war, you know. And so he went on this, you know, mission mm-hmm. of finding the remains. And finally, he found the remains in Jonesboro. And he brought them to his parish in North Alabama, and that's where he's buried
yeah.
Today. And so I was driving through that area a couple of years ago and did a side trip to go see that.
Yeah, because he'd been a monk
yeah. in
Probe, the Abbey, St. Vincent,
oh, wow.
Pennsylvania, and then was sent as to be as a parish priest in Nashville. And I remember that the monks back at the monastery had no idea what had happened to him. He just said, just banned
yeah.
so to speak, and it was. I have heard that account of that fellow priest finding out where he was buried, and making sure that his remains were given a proper burial.
Yeah. So, Father, I have to ask you then: of these many chaplains, you know, is there one chaplain that has stuck out to you, or one in particular that you've frequented in your research, or anything like that?
Oh, there's several. Comes I mentioned Father John Bannon. There's an incredible account mm-hmm. of him at the Siege of Vicksburg. He's preparing to offer Sunday Mass at St. Edward's, the parish, the Catholic Church there. The time and a naval artillery round comes through the building and misses him by a few inches as he's preparing for Mass, goes out the back wall and explodes, raining down brick and mortar and plaster on everybody. He contemplated, and he was built like a fullback. He was like well over 6 foot tall, big. I mean, he would have been,
wow.
you know, starting, you know, first team. He would have been played varsity in high school for certain. Wade Condor, but also had that personality. And then, offered to proceed to offer masses if nothing happened. There's certainly Father William Corby of Notre Dame fame and his statue at Gettysburg. And there's the original, yep. that I think, is at the campus at Notre Dame in Portuguese.
Yeah.
First down Corby, because he's standing like this. You know, he's actually giving general absolution. He gave it the second day at Gettysburg. He also gave general absolution at Antietam on horseback, yeah. Which he would have been a target at that distance. They would not, the Confederates don't know that, oh, this is the chaplain. No, he's on horseback as the brigade is going into the attack on the sunken road. But what stands out for me is Father Peter Whelan. He's also known as the Angel of Andersonville. Whelan was born in Ireland, had come to the United States, I think around 1830, in Savannah, Georgia, served as a priest in Georgia and South Carolina for about 30 years. And when the war starts, he's in his, I think he's around 60 years old, around that, I think late 50s, early 60s. serves as a chaplain of the Confederate Army. A lot of your prisoners were part of an artillery unit that served at Fort Pulaski. Was taken prisoner. Winds up, he didn't have to go into captivity as a non-combatant, but said, no, I'm staying with the men. Again, one of those examples of a priest or a chaplain that's willing to share the burdens and the hardships of the soldiers is immensely respected. He winds up in New York, near New York City, as a POW for a time. Winds up, he gives most of his stuff away to other prisoners. Some of the officers wind up pulling their resources to buy him a new set of clothes, because his clothes in such a shabby condition. They give it to him, and then they're surprised the next day they see it, and Whelan has given it to another inmate, another POW, who is even worse off than he was. So he's wearing this brand new set of clothes. Whelan eventually is paroled, goes back to Georgia. By that time, it's 1964, they've heard about a prison of war camp in southwest Georgia, a place near Andersonville. So he's also the vicar general of the Diocese of Savannah, by the way. So he's sent there to check it out. He goes anywhere it's the peak of the worst of the conditions in the summer of 1864. He's there for about 3 months. He's in his early 60s. He stays about a mile away and lives in a little shack, gets up every morning, walks to the prison, goes in about 9 a.m, stays until sundown, and it's in the summer. So it means the sun's not going down till 8, 9 o'clock. So he's put in 12-hour days. Horrid conditions. He's taking care of the dying, caring for the sick. And remember, Whelan was pro-Confederate, and so these men were the enemy. They were enemy combatants. In the 1850s, about a decade before, there had been violent anti-Catholic riots throughout many cities in the North. And it's not inconceivable that some of these same Union prisoners of war had participated in those riots. But Whelan saw past all that. He said, I'm a priest. This is where I need to be. So he's there every day, nearly for 3 months, is able to beg and borrow about $16,000, not how much that would be in our money today, to buy about 10,000 pounds of flour that he has made into loaves of bread. They were called Whelan bread, and he would pass out to the inmates. And a number of them credited their survival to him. And he saw past the uniform. He saw past the conflict. He saw past the majority of these Union POWs would not have been Catholic. That didn't matter to him. So he cared for them until throughout that summer. There are accounts of other clergy eventually went there. He was the only clergy going there. Now, eventually, even the Bishop of Savannah went there. Other priests, Protestant clergy, go there as well. There's an account from a young priest that was sent to help him, who in later years wrote, "Well, basically, I spent 3 days vomiting because I was so overcome with the smell, the sights, the horrific conditions," and where he said, "Well, Father Whelan said, well, I appreciate you trying to show up to help, but you're not helping. You know, he puts in so many words. So you need to go. You know, I can't take care of you and them at the same time." But he stayed there until his own health broke, I think in August, September, around of 1864. It turns out he also contracts tuberculosis while he's there serving the prisoners at Andersonville. He winds up back in Savannah in time for when Sherman shows up during the siege. I think the Union troops actually one time dig entrenchments through a cemetery.
Oh, wow.
So he's getting in their face about that. So, but he dies, I think 1870, 71, and he's in his late 60s and has the biggest funeral in the history of Savannah to that point. That's how much so he stands up. And also for me, as I mentioned before, I'm now in my early 60s, and reminder that even when you're at my age and you've been a priest for 30 years, which I've been almost 31, is like maybe the most important thing the Lord needs you to do is still ahead of you.
Yeah. Because what's fascinating about his life is you talk about many who died during the war or shortly after the war, but for him to go through what he went through and he survived all that, and he died a few years later. But to experience Andersonville, I mean, he could have died at Andersonville during his time there, and he survived that, and for a reason. And so that's incredible, and I think that's a good example, testament to just the Catholic priests during the war, who's just trying to help both sides in this human conflict like that. And well, yeah, thank you for sharing that testimony, his story. Mm-hmm. And I was actually, while preparing for this too, I haven't read it all the way, but I have the diary of Father James Sheeran.
Oh, yeah.
He was a Redemptorist priest. And he was a chaplain with a Louisiana regiment, I believe. The 14th Louisiana. Yep. That's right. And I thought it was fitting. I have an excerpt here because Easter Sunday wasn't that long ago. Okay. This is his Easter Sunday entry for April 5th, 1863. Mm-hmm. And this is when the Army of Northern Virginia was encamped near Fredericksburg.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right before the Chancellorsville campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but this was a fascinating, just short little account. And it says, "Today, Easter Sunday, is one which I shall ever remember on account of a few remarkable circumstances. It had more the appearance of a day in cold December than one in April, or of a Christmas day than an Easter Sunday. The snow had been falling all night, and early in the morning it continued to come down so thickly that one could hardly see 50 yards distant. I was somewhat sad at the prospect this morning presented. Anticipating pleasant weather, we expected to celebrate Easter in a joyful manner. We were to have Mass at 8 a.m., and a large number of Catholics of the brigade were prepared to go to communion. But now, what was to be done? The snow was so deep that I could hardly make my way to the camp, and were I there, could I expect the man to stand out in it during the time of Mass? I resolved, however, to start for camp, although a strong wind was blowing from that direction, drifting the snow in dense clouds. I took my latitude and started. For a few moments I was making in the right direction, but the snow blowing against my glasses caused me to lose my way, and after going through, I know not where, for about half an hour, something like what the boys call blind man's bluff, I found myself in the camp a quarter of a mile distant from ours. Then I found a colored man who kindly accompanied me to our camp, where to my great surprise I found a large concourse of boys around my tent. To see so many of our brave soldiers standing nearly knee-deep in the snow, cheerfully awaiting the offering of the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, was perhaps one of the most consoling sights of my life, and never did I pray more fervently for my congregation than on this occasion. But if it was an edifying sight to see them standing in the snow before Mass commenced, how much more so to see them on their bended knees, with uncovered heads, defying, as it were, the angry elements during the offering of the Holy Sacrifice. The greater number of those present received Holy Communion, after which we recited the Rosary of our Blessed Mother as part of our thanksgiving. My sermon this day was necessarily short, as I did not wish to detain the poor men in the cold. I announced that I was to leave camp on the following day in order to visit the other portions of General Lee's army and give the Catholic soldiers belonging to it an opportunity of making their Easter communion.
Yeah.
I heard some confessions in the evening. The forenoon was soft and cold, and the afternoon clear and pleasant, towards night somewhat frosty. Notwithstanding the disagreeable weather, the boys were cheerful and happy."
Mm.
But that is his Easter Sunday entry, 1863. But I thought that really, in a short account, really sums up many of the duties of a Catholic priest chaplain in one entry like that. And talking about offering Mass, the Rosary, and confessions all in the frigid snow of that time. So I thought that was an interesting account.
Yeah. Here's one also I think we're hearing. It's from, it's written by Lucius Barber of the 15th Illinois. About the chaplain, he was I think it was a Protestant, I think a Methodist chaplain, if I remember correctly. Again, the idea that if you're going to be putting yourself out there, motivated, doing what was good for the men, they were going to have immense respect for you. And Barber's writing this about 30 years after the war. He says, "Although not a gifted man or an eloquent speaker, yet I will venture to say that there was not a harder working chaplain in the whole army, or one that did more good. With a good education, he combined goodness of heart with an indomitable energy and perseverance. Our chaplain could not rest unless doing something good for the men. But I think they, you know, three decades later, that's what stands out, his experience of the chaplain that he was blessed with to have in his regiment. So.
Wow. Yeah. You're right about, you know, the ones who did their duty well and performed their service were the ones that were really praised by the men like that. And it's always amazing, the ones that were respected by both sides as well with that. So, you know, all this being said, I know we name dropped a few books here and there, but like, is there a particular book about any of these chaplains that you frequent or would recommend?
Yeah, one that was good, it's handed for me, Faith in the Fight by Civil War Chaplains. It's a series of essays. This came out a number of years ago. This is a good, like a basic overview.
That's good.
This is another one, A Shield and a Hiding Place, Religious Life in the Civil War Armies, by Gardner Shattuck, who is an Episcopal minister himself. Then you've got some of the memoirs, Corby's book.
Yes, of
him giving absolution at Gettysburg. There's also, I've got the Confederacy's fighting chaplain, Father John O'Bannon, by Philip Thomas Tucker.
Mm.
This is also a good one. It gives that account of him at Vicksburg with the artillery shell flying through the. Yeah, I've had some distractions at mass before, but yeah, that having
that's a big one.
Yeah, that'd be another one. If you really kind of get really kind of more scholarly type, would be Religion and the American Civil War. It also brings up that, you know, the United States was a overwhelmingly Protestant Christian country in 1860, even though not everybody went to church. They saw themselves as Christians. They read the Bible. They knew the scriptures. And so on. And interesting, this is one of the, has the cover on it of the iconic picture of Father Thomas Mooney offering mass. Is one of those rare pictures we know exactly where it was taken. It was taken in June of 1861. It's before First Bull Run. These are the men of what becomes the Irish Brigade. Mooney was a parish priest in New York City, and he's there offering mass. But he's a chaplain for about 3 months. And what happens, he gets in trouble with his bishop.
Oh, wow.
Because you never want to get in trouble with your bishop. Okay, don't want to rub the boss the wrong way. Because I mentioned that for Catholic priests, you had permission of your bishop or your superior. And what Mooney does, another Irishman, he consecrates 4 artillery pieces with holy oil.
Oh, wow.
And the news gets back to New York very quickly, and his bishop John Hughes.
Oh wow, yeah.
And he was you have to understand that Catholic bishop this day will officially sign something to put a cross in front of their signature. Well, with John Hughes, Bishop John Hughes, it was said to resemble more of a dagger, so his nickname was Dagger John. And he also had kind of a personality that kind of, because also he's living through these riots that are going on. In fact, he let it be known.
Yeah.
In New York City didn't have those riots because he let it be known that, well, you know, these Irish, you know, if you start burning down their churches and schools and homes and shops, I can't control them. They just might do the same thing to you and then some. So kind of put it out like that. So there was
the
riots didn't have because of John, and he did a lot of other, you know, really good things as well. But his bishop, Father Mooney's bishop, finds out about this, and immediately revokes his permission.
Oh wow!
With the Irish Brigade. So then you have, William Corby and several other priests that came.
Yeah.
Mostly Holy Cross priest, I think a Jesuit or two that they come in and take their place. But I find it's interesting that this guy who's a chaplain for 90 days gets in trouble with his bishop, gets his permission revoked. You Google Civil War religion, you know, Civil War clergy religion. Boom, that picture is going to come up about 98% of the time. So I said, a little bit of irony and a little bit of background story to that. So,
which talking about some of these interesting stories too. Like I remember I didn't I own several of the books that you showed, and I haven't read all of them all the way through. I'm more or less kind of am researching different aspects here and there. And when I was going through the Father Bannon book, I came across the part where he goes on this mission to go to Ireland
Oh, yeah.
undercover, like supposedly undercover, and he's going to persuade all the influx of Irish immigrants, and he's trying to encourage or kind of talk a lot of them out of going to the United States or fighting for the North. But he ends up the mission, if you will, does it kind of backfires because he goes and he just finds just how horrible the situation is in Ireland, and nobody wants to stay there. And nobody really cares what he has to say.
Yeah, but as I understand,
But
he never returned to the United States. He stayed in Ireland, became a Jesuit, and preached a mission in every parish church in Ireland by the time he died.
wow, that's
And so,
crazy.
talk about guys, self-starters, you know.
Yeah.
Now, another book, more recent, I've got is this. One of our associate pastors gave this to me, Soldiers of the Cross Authoritative Text. And this was published just a couple of years ago. And it's
Oh.
based on a manuscript by David Power. Cogninham, who was a veteran of the Civil War, was Irish Catholic, and wrote this as a manuscript, and then he died before it was published.
Wow.
And it basically sat in the
Okay.
archives of the University of Notre Dame for over a century. So that's been edited, was published. It is kind of the flowery language of the time. It also documents a number of priests and also women Catholic religious of their
Yes.
they were doing that, which is a whole other podcast. You could do that just on them. Now,
Yeah.
it is in kind of the language at the time, and also that he is unapologetically triumphant Catholic. You know, he's just
Yeah.
so if you're not a Catholic, you read this,
Yeah.
keep that in
Well,
mind. You know, that's where he's coming from. And so,
I didn't realize that. I hadn't even heard of that one, so
yeah,
I need to look into that.
one of
Wow.
our previous associates
Yeah. Yeah.
Christmas and read it not long ago, and he does go into an aspect, which is the priest I was not aware of. It was he asked what the author did after the war. He wrote to these priests and these religious, these nuns, what did you do during the war? And he was trying to
Okay.
put together this book, and these were the responses that he got. And also he found it very difficult to get the nuns to respond. They didn't really,
Yeah.
because of their humility, he said, well, they were sick, we took care of them.
Yeah.
What is there to write
Yeah.
about? So that was kind of their
It sounds like this is the Catholic version of the Batchelder Papers from
Yeah.
Gettysburg, yeah, pretty much. But to join the club here of holding up books, this is the one I read from. The Civil War Diary of Father James Sheeran,
Yeah.
edited by Patrick Hayes. And this was fairly new. I picked this up just a couple years ago. The Catholic University of America published it
Okay.
7 years ago. So this is fairly new. But that's one that I own. I need to add to my library, obviously, here. But yeah, wow, that's a lot of reading material. So, and I always say this, never fear, everyone. I'm going to have the titles of all these in the show notes.
Good.
And so we'll have all that information for you.
Yeah.
Changing subject again here, I'm kind of curious, in your own studies of history, and of course, you've recreated so many different units and all the living history units that we do, but do you have a pet regiment, if you will? Do you have a regiment that you kind of just always go back to in your studies or you like to frequent in your research?
Oh, yeah.
Is there such a one for you?
Oh yeah, and unapologetically, it was regiments in which people in my family were in, you know.
Yes.
And it's the I mentioned earlier the 16th South Carolina with my great grandfather, his dad, and they were known as the Greenville Regiment, and they were shot to pieces at Franklin. By that time, he was not there, but the other two members of the family that were at, three members of the family that were in that regiment still at Franklin and Nashville, none of them survived. They either killed outright or were mortally wounded. So there's also, and then on my dad's side of the family, the direct ancestor that was the Tennessee, it was with the Alabama Unionists serving Tennessee Regiment. There's hardly, there may be four paragraphs written about his regiment, so you really can't study that. But there's a distant branch of the family. They were wound up in Southern Illinois, and they were in the 31st Illinois Infantry. John Logan was the
Yeah.
colonel. And I discovered those guys a number of years ago, and just immense respect for them because they were two brothers. They enlisted with their cousin. They were all under the age of 21. Their cousin was killed at Fort Donaldson 7 months later. The two other brothers, they survived the war. They reenlisted. That's the thing that they after having gone through those campaigns, they were in the Vicksburg campaign. They were amongst the first troops to march into Vicksburg when it surrendered. And then they reenlisted. They knew, unlike before, they knew exactly what they were signing up for the second. And they survived. They lived in the Atlanta campaign. They marched the sea. They marched the Carolinas. That took part in the Grand Review in May of 1865, marching down Constitution Avenue, and then were immediately mustered out of service and went back to Southern Illinois. And neither one of them were the age of 25.
Wow.
But by the time the war was over, I think they were the older of the two was 23 or 24. And that's a regiment that I have a lot of respect for. And I've actually gone to Vicksburg and the Illinois Monument. Actually, found their names in the Illinois Memorial that's there. So those would be two regiments: one north, one south.
Yeah, that's great. And they're worthy of a podcast episode too.
But Western Theater, by the way, I show my bias about.
Well, you know, I'm trying. the more I go and progress on this, I'm trying to show both theaters some love, and right. There's so many, I feel like, yeah, there's so many, like, I mean, within the history buff community, there's a lot of household name units, you know, Irish Brigade, Iron Brigade, 20th Maine.
Oh, yeah.
But there's just so many Western regiments, especially in the Union Army in the West, the 31st Illinois being one, and there's so many, like, 21st Ohio or the 125th Ohio, or like some of these other well-known like Western units that are respected and renowned, but they just don't get, you know, near the attention. And so I want to start showing some more love to our Western compatriots here.
Yeah, if you get into the Mississippi West, the 24th Missouri U.S., second Colorado Infantry, they fought at Glorieta Pass. They walked, they marched from Denver to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and then now West Eastern Oklahoma, fought at Honey Springs, the biggest Civil War battlefield in Oklahoma was Oklahoma. Then later were made into a cavalry unit. But those guys, I mean, that's often that you've really got to be searching for information about them. But so if you're looking for new things to study west of the Mississippi, those are two Union regiments. And then, but also with the Missouri State Guard, 15th Northwest Arkansas, the 34th Arkansas Confederate, those guys were at Prairie Grove. They were literally fighting in their own backyard. Some of the companies were from that county, where the adjacent counties were, Fayetteville, Bentonville, where Walmart is now, you know, the...
Yes, yeah, that's right. I passed there.
And so come and see it before Walmart builds another distribution center. So if you're also looking for Civil War battlefield sites to visit out west of the Mississippi, Prairie Grove is a good one. Pea Ridge and Wilson's Creek are probably two of the best national... They were owned by the National Park Service. Are two of the best preserved. There are hardly any monuments on them at all. So you do get a feel of what it would have looked like at that time. And I know Pea Ridge particularly, they're going a lot of effort to try to restore the landscape, where there were trees, where there wasn't trees, where they had the prairie, and how tall the prairie grass would have been, those sorts of things. They're making a really, really good effort of that.
But, you know, I've been to all three of those and just went to Wilson's Creek about a year ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And got that off my bucket list. And that was, you're right, there's a lot of property preserved there. But, yeah, there's no, if you're a monument person, it's not the best. But it's very well preserved. There's a few views there that are probably very similar to how it would have looked.
Right.
And I really liked the Pea Ridge battlefield when I went, because I went for that. We were both part of that 24th Missouri adjunct,
right?
The 150th. And One of my favorite parts about that whole event was camping at Elkhorn Tavern. That was a really cool that night before our big march the next day. And
Friday,
but camping there, that was a cool venue to participate in. I enjoyed that.
I do remember that because I got there and I live very close. That's less than a 2 hour drive from where I
am. Oh, wow.
So I get there and, you know, I'm kind of feeling my age a little bit and thinking like, man, why do I still do this? It's like, this is this is great. I got other things to do. But then by the end of it, I'm like, man, I'm so glad I came. You know, like, this is so cool getting to do this and hanging out with guys that have the same interest on this. And, you know, that sort of, so it's one of the things like, oh, I can't believe I do this, but boy, I really love doing this. It was kind of by the.
That sums up all living history all in one, because I do it too. Like, while I'm there, I'm like, this is horrible. This is terrible. But then on the drive home or the next event, we're all cutting up laughing about it. And
yeah, it's the idea.
So
like, actually,
embrace the suck, as they say. Well, you're already talking about Battlefield. So, you know, those are a lot in your close proximity, you know, and are some of those your favorites? And are there any that you, in your many, many travels, of course, all over the place for this, are there a few favorites of yours that you really like to try to get to?
Well, one, because it's literally in the backyard, is Honey Springs. It's now Northeast Oklahoma, largest battle in our state. And I've seen it grow up from next to nothing to where now they made a really good effort to preserve as much of the battlefield as they can. They do have a good now a interpretive center, visitor center. It's owned by the State Historical Society. And so if you're ever out this way, anybody's, if you're into that, it's about 20 miles south of Muskogee, Oklahoma.
Okay.
Made famous by Merle Haggard and Okie from Muskogee. I was the pastor there. I was the Catholic pastor for 10 years.
Wow.
So it's very accessible from the interstate. It's just a bit north of I-40 in that area. And it's worth seeing. As you see, it's developed over time where it is now. That'd be one I would recommend. It's like some of the ones you don't hear too much about. Mine Creek up in Kansas is another one. It's near the Kansas-Missouri border. South of Kansas City, but north of Pittsburgh, Kansas. Those places are in my kind of my neck of the woods, to where I can access more freely. If you really want to do a history geek thing, there is a book. I don't have it with me right now. You can go on the in Springfield, Missouri. You can go part of what was known as the Texas Road, that takes you down into Fort Smith. It took like 3 days off in the middle of the week, and actually driving a part of the, and you go right through the battlefield at Pea Ridge. Somebody actually had you know, go so X number of miles, and then turn right, and then do this, and you're on now the original part of the road, and then so I was able to do it. And Fort Smith's got some interesting things as well, as in terms of history of history things. So, but yeah, those sorts of places. Of course, you know, the big places would be like the Gettysburg, Vicksburg, Chickamauga, which, you know, where we were at this artillery thing, we drive right through the park. Had family that were there, that was there. So that's and also I think that was the first national battlefield park established, I think, in the 90s. Those places, Franklin, Tennessee, they're doing more and more preserving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we can bulldoze the Pizza Huts and return it back something of what it may have resembled. So, and since I had family that was there that were killed or mortally wounded, I kind of feel like, no, I wanted to see to do what I can in terms of historical preservation. The Carrington House and Carter House are dead. It's a privately, there's not, so you got to pay, you know, a little bit more money. Also, other history geek thing, Kansas City, the Arabia Museum, the Steamship Arabia. You would have thought I was 8 years old and it was Christmas Eve getting to go and see it. But you just see all, it's basically, it was a steamboat sunk in 18, 1856, I think 58, right at the time, pre-Civil War, Sunken River, Kansas City, hit a tree, submerged tree, sank. It's basically taking that, imagine sinking a Walmart, all this stuff, like in a Walmart, because all this stuff was headed up the river to Council Bluffs, Iowa, Omaha, Nebraska, all these trade goods. So you see buttons, shoes, coats, tools, nail, you name it. It was there, and it's just, and they're trying to preserve. They found it. They dug it up. By this time, the river had shifted, and so it was basically in somebody's soybean field, and they were able to, you know, to extract a lot of it. Just to go to see that, that's, if you're out in this part of the, that's worth seeing. In fact, as I'm trying to put together an impression as a civilian pre-war or the country. So anything that was, oh, we copied it from the Arabia. It's like, here, take my money.
It's funny you mentioned this, because
42 coat, here, take my money.
Well, I was just in Kansas City a year ago, and I only had a couple hours to spend in Kansas City. And so I was limited what I could do. And so I narrowed it down to Steamboat Arabia or the National World War One Museum. And I chose the National World War One Museum.
Wrong. You didn't choose wrong. I've seen that. And that is, and another part of the family history. My mother's father was a German immigrant, and he was in the Great War.
Wow.
He was a teenage German soldier on the Western Front at Verdun.
Wow.
And he lived into his 90s, and I adored him, and I respect. In fact, right before I came on, I actually had come across found some of his letters that he had written in the 90s about some of his experiences and things like that. So I went to that museum looking, okay, yeah, Opa told me about that. Oh yeah, he told me about, you know, or
wow.
For me, it was kind of a different experience as well, because I'm thinking that I had a direct connection to somebody in my family that I knew. I wasn't just related to by two, three generations.
Yeah.
But like the Civil War, but somebody that actually knew and who lived through all that.
Yeah, that's an incredible. Yeah, I encourage anyone to go to that, because I was not prepared for the amount of detail in that museum as well. Yeah. Like I didn't have time. Like I had to fly through it kind of, but like there was cases and cases of badges and artifacts and so much. Like there was an area with nothing but like propaganda posters from World War One, you know, and it was incredible the amount of artifacts that they have. And I need to go back.
Like you, I got to spend maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a seminary about 100 miles north of Kansas City that I was asked to be there, a speaker for a day of reflection for the seminarian. So I was there, and on the way back, I stopped, like, yeah, I'm going into this museum. And but nice. They definitely could have spent a whole lot more time.
Yeah.
They have a very good YouTube channel about, they'll do lectures from them.
Oh.
And it's worth
it. Okay.
I mean, they'll give all sorts of stuff about the war, multiple different angles, the different combatants. I can't remember the name of the YouTube channel, it's off of my head, but
yeah, I'll look it up.
Looking into,
and
those sorts of things. Yeah, the Arabia and the Great War Museum. If you're in the Kansas
Incredible.
Area, also from a Catholic angle, Oklahoma City, go to the shrine of Blessed Stanley Rother.
Yes,
he was the first. This is the Catholic thing here. The first Catholic priest born in the United States, diocesan priest, to be recognized as a martyr for the faith. He was grew up on a farm west of Oklahoma City, born in the 1930s, became a priest, wound up as a missionary in Guatemala, and was martyred in 1981. And it's this beautiful big church. It's been there for less than a year and a half, basically.
Become sure.
A pilgrimage. It was just... If you want to look, like, there's a bit of history. It's not Civil War history, but
no, it's fascinating.
And they have a very small little museum about his life.
Yeah,
he struggled academically in the seminary. He flunked out his first seminary because of Latin. And he winds up going to Guatemala, and he becomes fluent in a native dialect, a Mayan dialect. He helps to translate the New Testament into this language. The guy who flunked out because of Latin. You talk about a God thing.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Someone else who was completely dedicated to his people. that when he was under a threat of death, he was pulled out by his bishop, but begged to go back. He went back and was by death, was killed by death squad. But again, that dedication to the people that you're serving.
Yeah. Wow. What a testament there. And so please, check out all these things, all these historic battlefields or historic sites or museums. They're all well worth the visit. And I'm trying to, I have a bucket list of things and I'm slowly getting through them. And you really have to plan. Yeah, like you said, like when you're traveling to these events, it gives you excuses to knock off some of those things off the list there. And so as we start winding down, Father, we're coming to the end here. You know, I'm curious, is there another event on your radar that you're planning to attend soon? Yeah. And what's a final parting word that you would share with our listeners about today?
First, I haven't decided on something, but my bishop's given me permission to do a what we would call a pastoral sabbatical. Begins at the end of May, 3.5 months. And so my focus has now been on that, getting everything squared away to be gone for 3 months.
Sure, sure.
I get, you know, I have a meeting on Thursday night with the finance committee, you know, make sure we get the parish budget. So that's, but I'll be on retreat for a month, and then I'm going to do a Camino in Portugal and Spain. I'm going to go serve it as a chaplain at Lourdes in France and those sorts of things. So I've got to kind of think about maybe, it's not, if I do anything, it's not going to be probably till late this year, or sometime in 2025, and I've got to kind of
look. Yeah.
And again, it's kind of the unique thing.
Sure, sure.
You and I know the terms about like mainstream reenactments.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of those, and given the limitations on my time, it's just like, and I'm not so sure I really, unless it's really really close.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah,
I understand that.
So, but I have to be discerning. The sermon, I am looking at doing more stuff in the Kansas, Missouri area. They're doing more and more the Bleeding Kansas.
Okay.
So I might have to kind of see what's on the calendar.
Yeah, keep it close to home now and then. Yeah,
a few hours and not, you know, drive all night to get there.
Yeah.
So those are things. I haven't really decided on anything just yet.
Gotcha.
So we'll see. But there, I'm sure going to be some things we'll pick my end. and I will plan from there. But also kind of parting words is, again, thank you for the opportunity to come and speak. I had some technical difficulties with my battery, my phone, edit out all that makeup. I know you'll do a great job and make it look really good. So it's greatly appreciated. But not just that we see the example of others, of their dedication, they're willing to sacrifice. They're willing to do so out of the keeping the great commandments of this, as our Lord shares with us or tells us, you know, love God, love neighbor. And even in the most difficult of times, instead of war, of disaster, of crisis, so we look to those who've gone before us, who have shown it to us that can be done. And if they can do it, then we should take inspiration, and that we can do it with God's grace, God's cooperating with God's grace, so can we.
Amen. Amen. That's good. But thank you for joining me in this conversation tonight. And with a good perspective on the chaplaincy during the Civil War, and also sharing your own experiences there, so of living history as a Catholic priest and all that, and all the opportunities that you've had, and whether it be a moonlight experience in Arizona or a more sunlight experience in Northwest Georgia the other day, so. A lot of great opportunities. And so I thank you. And I hope those of you watching and listening, you know, you learned something new in this episode or pursue another aspect of of the war, the religion side of it, the faith of the soldiers, which was very taken very serious by many during the times of the Civil War. And so I thank you all for listening, tuning in, and stay tuned for more episodes. And again, thank you for watching and listening, and thank you for joining me, Father.
Well, God bless you and keep you safe.
Take care, everybody.
Bye.